Chapter 17. Poison. Alexander Litvinenko was already dead when he publicly accused Vladimir Putin of having killed him. A radioactive isotope had slowly but inexorably destroyed his body over 3 weeks. It was as if a little tiny nuclear bomb had gone off inside him. His doctors, who initially suspected that he had eaten tainted sushi, would not pinpoint the cause of his mysterious illness until it was too late. A dose of the element polonium-210. He had ingested it, it seemed, in the wood-paneled bar of the Mayfair Millennium Hotel in London on November 1, 2006, after briefly meeting a cadre of visiting Russians he hoped to entice into his new business enterprise, trading information on Russian power and business, which had taken on new significance now that Putin commanded the center of it. When he got home that evening, he began to feel ill. 3 days later, he was in the hospital, where he agonizingly withered away. He died the night of November 23rd, only 43 years old. The next morning, a friend and colleague, Alex Goldfarb, emerged before a circle of journalists and television cameras and read a statement Litvinenko had dictated in his dying days. "I can distinctly hear the beatings of the wings of the Angel of Death," it went, in improbably elegant English, which Litvinenko had barely learned to speak during his years in exile. "I may be able to give him the slip, but I have to say my legs do not run as fast as I would like. I think, therefore, that this may be the time to say one or two things to the person responsible for my illness. You may succeed in silencing men, but that silence comes at a price. You have shown yourself to be as barbaric and ruthless as your most hostile critics have claimed. You have shown you have no respect for life, liberty, or any civilized value. You have shown yourself to be unworthy of your office, to be unworthy of the trust of civilized men and women. You may succeed in silencing one man, but a howl of protest from around the world will reverberate, Mr. Putin, in your ears for the rest of your life." Litvinenko had not settled into a quiet exile after making a furtive escape from Russia in 2000, hounded by the agency he betrayed when he went public with his accusations at the surreal press conference in 1998, before the dawn of the Putin era. He had never fully integrated into English life, remaining within the insular world of Londongrad, populated with exiles, émigrés, and itinerant tycoons. He did not mingle socially with the rich Russians then flooding London with their wealth. His means were far too modest, but rather with the shadowy, conspiratorial circles of Putin's fiercest critics. Chief among them was Boris Berezovsky, who continued to contrive plots to discredit the man he blamed for his fall from political favor and wealth. With Berezovsky's financing and inspiration, Litvinenko wrote a book with Yuri Felshtinsky, an immigré historian based in the United States, which made the case that Putin's FSB had been behind the bombings in 1999 that propelled Putin to power. They called it "The FSB Blows Up Russia," and it was tendentious from its opening lines. "No one but a total madman could have wished to drag Russia into any kind of war, let alone a war in the North Caucasus, as if Afghanistan had never happened." A film version followed, shown discreetly in Moscow and extensively abroad, a campaign Berezovsky financed as part of his vengeful mission to bring Putin down. Litvinenko followed up with a second book, Lubyanka Criminal Group, portraying the KGB's successor as little more than a mafia or terrorist organization, engaged in corruption and crime. Litvinenko was burning the bridges to his past, to his own career in the security services, with a recklessness that at times verged on madness. He became consumed with Putin and his rule, trading information with other KGB veterans and with intelligence agents in Britain and Spain and possibly elsewhere. He was eager to pursue any morsel of information that he heard and willing to believe in vast conspiracies, which he knitted out of facts, rumors, and a furious imagination. At the end of his short life, his interest was piqued by rumors that Putin might be gay or bisexual, based in part on a brief, unsubstantiated anecdote in the memoirs of Yuri Skuratov, the former prosecutor, recalling Putin telling him that he believed a videotape existed showing him in a sexual tryst. The videotape has become a legend among Putin's critics, including former officers purged when Putin took over the FSB in 1998, who claim that various copies have been secreted abroad for safekeeping. No one seems to have actually seen it, and the accounts vary between an encounter with a young man in 1984, when he trained as a KGB foreign operative, to a tryst later in the same apartment where Skuratov was taped. In Litvinenko's mind, though, a mere probability could easily become an indisputable truth. On July 5th, less than 4 months before his poisoning, Litvinenko published his insinuation about Putin's sexuality after Putin awkwardly lifted the shirt of a young boy visiting Red Square and kissed him on the stomach. His article appeared on the website of Chechnya's rebel movement, a cause Litvinenko increasingly embraced after befriending another exile in London, the actor-turned-rebel spokesman Ahmed Zakayev, who had moved into a row house on the same street as Litvinenko in North London. Alek Kalugin, the spy in exile, warned him, when they met only months before his death, that peddling unsubstantiated innuendo was dangerous. "Sasha, it's too much," he told him. Litvinenko, already a traitor in the eyes of the FSB, had lost any sense of caution in what he presumed was the safety of exile. Even his daughter thought he was a little crazy. "Any conversation would end up with him going on about Putin's regime," she said. "He would wind himself up to such an extent he couldn't stop, as if he was out of his mind." Litvinenko continued to work for Berezovsky, but their relationship waned, and by 2006, Berezovsky had reduced the stipend he had been giving him to support his family. In search of steady income, Litvinenko then offered his services as a private investigator and researcher for firms that advised businesses on managing risk in Russia. His knowledge of the inner workings of the FSB, his obsessive collation of material, and his willingness to share led him into a labyrinth of investigations in the heart of Putin's Russia. In April 2006, he traveled to Israel to meet with one of Khodorkovsky's former Yukos partners, Leonid Nevzlin, who later said that Litvinenko had passed on information that shed light on the most significant aspects of the Yukos affair, though what precisely this consisted of was never made clear. A month later, he was in Spain, where he met security officers and a crusading prosecutor, Jose Grinda Gonzalez, with whom he discussed the activities and locations of several figures in the Russian mafia. He presented a thesis, which Grinda later endorsed, that the Russian government, through the FSB and the foreign and military intelligence branches, controlled organized crime gangs and used them to smuggle arms, launder money, carry out assassinations, and otherwise do whatever the government cannot acceptably do as a government. Grinda was on the trail of Russian criminals in Spain, including a reputed mafia boss named Gennady Petrov, who was in business during Putin's time in Petersburg, and for a time had been a shareholder in the institution that united Putin's inner circle of friends, Bank Russia. Litvinenko kept these visits secret, traveling on the British passport he had received when granted asylum. But then he consciously thrust himself into the public spotlight after what was, until his own death, one of the most shocking murders of a Putin critic. On the night of October 7, 2006, Putin's 54th birthday, an assassin followed Anna Politkovskaya into the hallway of her apartment building and shot her 4 times as she stood in the elevator. The assassin dropped the pistol beside her, the signature of a contract hit. Her murder was intended to shock, and it did. Politkovskaya had never relented in covering the war in Chechnya, even as most Russians turned away from what had become a grinding counterinsurgency operation, now largely carried out by forces loyal to Ramzan Kadyrov, the son of Putin's anointed leader Ahmad Kadyrov, who had been assassinated in Grozny in 2004. 2 days before Politkovskaya's murder, the younger Kadyrov had turned 30, making him legally old enough to take over as the republic's president. Putin had already made him the republic's prime minister, a post that was a mere formality since Kadyrov and his fighters held absolute control in Chechnya. At the time of her murder, Politkovskaya was preparing an article about the torture of a Chechen migrant from Ukraine who was beaten and electric shocked until he confessed to committing murders, another horrifying, though not exceptional, example of the brutality of Russia's war. Her newspaper, Novaya Gazeta, published the article 6 days after her death. Even she wondered whether these accounts of the war's atrocities had any impact on a population that tacitly supported the government's harsh tactics simply by not paying attention. Another article found in her computer was titled, "So What Am I Guilty Of?" It amounted to a lament for what journalism in Russia had become. "I have never sought my present pariah status, and it makes me feel like a beached dolphin," she wrote. In the same article, she pointedly criticized Putin's unblinking support for the younger Kadyrov. Putin, she wrote, appointed him as Chechnya's prime minister with blithe disregard for the fact that the man is a complete idiot, bereft of education, brains, or a discernible talent for anything other than mayhem and violent robbery. And yet, Putin's strategy in Chechnya ultimately proved ruthlessly effective. Aslan Maskhadov, the elected president of the republic during the brief period of independence between 1996 and 1999, had been cornered and killed in March 2005 in a basement only 12 miles from Grozny. His replacement as the political leader of the rebellion, Abdul Kalim Saidulayev, was killed a year later, betrayed by an informer, Kadyrov taunted, for the price of a dose of heroin. Months later, in July 2006, an explosion in Chechnya's neighboring republic, Ingushetia, killed Shamil Basayev, the notorious military commander and self-professed terrorist who had organized the sieges of Nordost and Beslan, among dozens of other attacks. The FSB claimed it was a special operation, while the insurgents claimed it was an accident. But the impact was indisputable. The string of killings decapitated the leadership of the rebellion that Putin had fought from the moment he rose to power, driving its adherents even deeper underground. The cost in blood and treasure was extraordinary, with thousands of Russian soldiers killed and thousands more Chechens displaced or disappeared. The brutality, the violence, the impunity, the repressive political and security tactics that characterized all of Russia but were amplified in the mountains on the southern border, would create disenfranchisement and grievance that would fester into an Islamic-tinged insurgency that the authorities could never snuff out. And yet, Putin's tactics and his support of the younger Kadyrov had succeeded in crushing Chechnya's independence movement. 3 months after Politkovskaya's death, using the authority he imposed after Beslan, Putin appointed Kadyrov Chechnya's new president. He was little more than a satrap, but Putin repaid his loyalty to the Kremlin by giving him absolute sovereignty to run Chechnya as his fief, which he did with ruthless cruelty against enemies and critics, people like Politkovskaya. She was one of the last casualties of Putin's victorious war. In 2008, too late for her to wield her acerbic wit against it, Kadyrov renamed a portion of the main street in the battered capital Grozny, which was at last being rebuilt with a massive infusion of cash from the federal budget. In the center of a city that had been flattened on Putin's command, Victory Avenue became Putin Avenue. Given Politkovskaya's prominence, her murder drew immense international attention and conspicuous silence from the Kremlin. Since she had an American passport, having been born in New York to Soviet diplomats at the United Nations in 1958, the American ambassador, William Burns, delivered an official démarche expressing concern and demanding a thorough investigation of the death of an American citizen. The deputy foreign minister he met, Andrei Denisov, seemed shocked by the murder and insisted that no one in a position of authority had anything to do with the crime, adding that many individuals could have benefited from Politkovskaya's death. Yet neither the Ministry of Foreign Affairs nor the Kremlin said anything at all. Few had any authority to speak out, especially on so sensitive a case, until the president himself signaled what the official line would be. And Putin said nothing until 3 days later, the day Politkovskaya was buried in a heavy rain with thousands of mourners lining up to pass her coffin. Putin had arrived that day in Dresden, his old KGB posting, for an official visit with Angela Merkel, the new chancellor who had replaced Schroeder, as well as with business executives promoting Russia's ever-expanding energy prospects. When they appeared together, Merkel joined in the international condemnation of Politkovskaya's assassination, but Putin said nothing in his comments. He addressed it only when a German reporter followed up with a question. Putin called it a horribly cruel crime, but he then belittled the journalist's work and suggested the true motive for her killing was to besmirch Russia's reputation. This journalist was indeed a fierce critic of the current authorities in Russia, but as the experts know, and as journalists should realize, I think, her impact on Russian political life was only very slight. Her murder, he said, dealt a greater blow to the authorities than anything she had written. He expounded on the theme later that night, when he told Russian and German officials meeting in the semi-annual forum known as the Petersburg Dialogue that Politkovskaya's assassination had been orchestrated by enemies of Russia. This would become a recurring theme. The enemies of Russia, of Putin, were conspiring to discredit him. We have reliable, consistent information that many people who are hiding from Russian justice have been harboring the idea that they will use somebody as a victim to create a wave of anti-Russian sentiment in the world, he told them. This was exactly what Litvinenko sought to do. He considered Politkovskaya a friend. Whenever she visited London, the two traded information about Chechnya and the security services working there, and her death enraged him. On October 19th, less than 2 weeks before he fell ill, he attended a panel discussion in London on Politkovskaya's murder and declared that Putin himself was culpable. He rose from the crowd to address the panel, beginning in halting English, and then continuing in Russian as a woman sitting beside Ahmed Zakayev translated. After emphasizing that he had nothing to hide and repeating several times that the journalists there should feel free to quote his remarks, he said that Politkovskaya herself had received a warning that Putin had put her on a hit list. I know very well that only one person in Russia could kill a journalist with the standing of Anna Politkovskaya, and that is Putin, no one else. 13 days later, he collected the evidence he was sure would help him prove the case. An Italian security analyst, Mario Scaramella, who traded in the same secrets he did, shared emails that had been sent by another Russian in exile purporting to be the hit list of an association of KGB veterans called Dignity and Honor. Politkovskaya's name was on the list. So were Litvinenko's and Berezovsky's. And yet Litvinenko seemed to let his guard down when he left his lunch meeting with the Italian to meet the two Russians who would become the chief suspects in his murder, Andrei Lugovoy and Dmitry Kovtun. Lugovoy, also a veteran of the KGB department that provided protection for government officials, had once run security for the television station controlled by Berezovsky. He now owned a security company called the Ninth Wave and remained in contact with Berezovsky. Kovtun was a childhood friend of Lugovoy's, who served as a captain in the Soviet Red Army's military intelligence branch in East Germany, and owned a business consulting company. Litvinenko knew Lugovoy through his connection with Berezovsky and was eager to bring him into his orbit of contacts, which included Irinis, a security company where Litvinenko sometimes worked as a consultant. Lugovoy introduced Kovtun during that visit in October, meeting at Irinis and afterward at a Chinese restaurant. The authorities in Britain later disclosed that the first attempt to kill Litvinenko had happened at the security company, using the same radioactive poison. He felt sick afterward, vomiting that night, but he recovered. The three met again on the November day he fell gravely ill. It was Litvinenko who urgently insisted on seeing them this time, before a meeting already planned for the following morning. He was eager to share what he had learned from the emails that Mario Scaramella had shared over lunch. Their meeting at the Mayfair Millennium's Pine Bar was short, since Lugovoy, who was traveling with his family, had tickets to a soccer match between Arsenal and CSKA Moscow that night at Emirates Stadium. When his son arrived at the bar, he introduced him to Litvinenko, and then he left to change his clothes for the match. Kovtun thought Litvinenko looked strange, agitated, and perhaps unwell. "He didn't close his mouth," he said. As Kovtun waited for Lugovoy in the lobby, Litvinenko clung uncomfortably close to his side. "I was standing too close to him," Kovtun said. "He kept talking and talking." After the British authorities determined what poison had killed Litvinenko, polonium-210, they ultimately found residual traces of it everywhere the three men had been. Not just on November 1st, but during their previous meetings on October 16th and 17th. It contaminated their hotel rooms, the conference room where they met at Irinis, the seat at Emirates Stadium where Lugovoy sat, the seat cushions at the Hey Joe strip club and a hookah at the Dar Marrakesh restaurant, which Lugovoy and Kovtun had visited. It irradiated two British Airways jets that flew between Moscow and London, and even the couch in the house of Kovtun's ex-wife in Hamburg, Germany, which Kovtun had visited only days before he flew again to London to meet Litvinenko the second time, and where, according to testimony made public years later, he asked a friend if he could recommend a chef who might be able to deliver a dose of poison. Polonium-210 occurs naturally in minute quantities in the Earth's crust, in the air, and in tobacco smoke. But when manufactured, it appears as a silvery soft metal. It was once used in the triggers of nuclear weapons and is produced in small amounts to eliminate static electricity in industrial machinery and to remove dust from film and camera lenses. It decays by emitting alpha particles that travel only a few inches and are easily stopped by a sheet of paper or a person's skin. The only health risk comes when it is ingested. Easily and safely handled and lethally toxic, it is an ingenious weapon. 97% of the world's industrial supply comes from Avangard, a Russian nuclear facility in the heavily guarded city of Sarov, where the Soviet Union built its first atom bomb. As happened with Politkovskaya's murder, Putin was traveling when Litvinenko's death exploded into a global media frenzy. This time he was in Helsinki for a summit with the European Union that had already gone poorly, and as he prepared for the ritual press conference that culminated such meetings, Putin's spokesman, Dmitry Peskov, delivered the news about Litvinenko's deathbed accusation, knowing he would surely be asked to respond. Putin was livid, incredulous that he had been accused of being personally involved in Litvinenko's death. The timing, he and his aides believed, could not be a coincidence. It could only be a provocation. When he appeared with the prime ministers of Finland, Iceland, and Norway, along with the European Union's two senior officials, Putin's discomfort was palpable. He grimaced, shifted, and stared at the ceiling. His aides on the sidelines suggested to reporters that he had a cold, but he seemed to be suppressing the fury that Peskov said he felt. None of the leaders who spoke from the dais pretended that the meetings had been a success, though they diplomatically expressed hope that the efforts to forge closer economic and social ties would continue. After they finished speaking, the first question was about Litvinenko. Would Putin respond to the accusation that he was responsible? Putin, normally cocksure in these press appearances, answered awkwardly. "A person's death is always a tragedy," he began, and then offered his condolences to Litvinenko's family. As he had with Politkovskaya's murder, he tried to play down the victim and obfuscate the circumstances. The British doctors, he said, had not indicated that this was a violent death. He suggested that the British authorities bore responsibility for protecting the country's citizens. He offered Russia's assistance if an investigation was warranted, and urged the British not to support any tendency to inflate any political scandals which are groundless. As for the note, he questioned why it had not been made public while Litvinenko was alive. If it was written after his death, Putin said, there was no need to comment. The people who have done this are not God, and Mr. Litvinenko is, unfortunately, not Lazarus, he said. And it is very much a pity that even such tragic events like a person's death can be used for political provocations. As he had in Politkovskaya's case, Putin sought to deflect blame elsewhere, to his enemies. And yet nowhere in his short, awkward remarks did he come out and explicitly deny that the Russians had done it. No direct evidence has yet emerged that Putin had any involvement in Litvinenko's death or Politkovskaya's or any of the other mysterious and unsolved crimes that bore the hallmarks of political assassination during his rule. By now, however, his standing in the West had sunk so low that few doubted that, at the very least, he had created a climate that made political murder grimly ordinary. In the wake of Litvinenko's poisoning, older cases suddenly took on new significance. Yuri Shekhachikin, a member of parliament and a journalist who also worked for Politkovskaya's newspaper, died in 2003 after a sudden illness that suggested a poisoning. He had just written an article about a stalled investigation that now, 3 years later, was about to surface amid renewed intrigue. Another case involved the strange death of a man supposedly acting as a mediator in the Yukos affair in 2004. The victim, Roman Tsepov, an acquaintance of Putin's in the 1990s, died in a manner that eerily foreshadowed Litvinenko's case. He succumbed to radiation sickness only days after supposedly having been invited for a cup of tea at the FSB's headquarters in Petersburg. Litvinenko's poisoning had all the intricacy and intrigue of a John le Carré novel, minus only a coherent motive and a climactic resolution. Back in Moscow, Lugovoy and Kovtun did not act like suspects. Lugovoy had called Litvinenko twice after learning he was ill, but before anyone knew of the cause. This did not seem to be the action of a murderer. When his name surfaced as one of those who had met Litvinenko on November 1st, he presented himself at the British Embassy, agreeing to meet the diplomats to clarify the situation and to be interviewed by British investigators. The chair he sat on was so irradiated with polonium-210 that the embassy sealed the room. On the day after Litvinenko's death, he and Kovtun granted an interview to the radio station Echo Moskvy, expressing bewilderment over the whole affair, and they continued to speak out for months afterward, denying any complicity. Later, they insisted they were the intended victims, either with, by, or instead of Litvinenko. To kill him, and more so in such an extravagant way, was absolutely beyond understanding, Kovtun said. If he and Lugovoy were hired assassins dispatched to London, Kovtun insisted, they would have been sent after the most wanted men on Russia's list of enemies, not an insignificant one like Litvinenko. In fact, Lugovoy had met Berezovsky the day before Litvinenko's poisoning. Lugovoy always had the chance to meet with Berezovsky, Zakhaev, with all of them together. Since he had the chance to meet any of them, it would be easy to kill the more important target. In the shadowy world they inhabited, the argument made a certain amount of sense. Putin did his best to ignore the drama, but Russian officials vigorously tried to undercut the narrative taking shape around the world. They did so with more zeal than they showed in investigating the murder itself. When traces of polonium-210 were found in Kovtun's system, the Prosecutor General's office announced an investigation into his attempted murder. A month later, it announced, without evidence or even explanation, that Litvinenko's death was linked somehow to ongoing prosecutions against Yukos. When Putin appeared at a press conference in February 2007, he dismissed Litvinenko as an inconsequential guard in the border troops who had abused his oath of office and then fled the country. There was no need to run anywhere. He did not have any secrets. Everything negative that he could say with respect to his service and his previous employment, he already said a long time ago, so there could be nothing new in what he did later. Instead, he claimed, the enemies who sought to harm Russia were the runaway oligarchs hiding in Western Europe or in the Middle East. He clearly meant Nevzlin and Berezovsky, suggesting, with as little evidence as those who accused him, that they somehow had a hand in Litvinenko's death. But I do not really believe in conspiracy theories. Russia, though, had become fertile ground for conspiracies, real and imagined, and the deaths of Litvinenko, Politkovskaya, and the others challenged the carefully cultivated impression that Putin presided over an era of progress, stability, and renewed national pride that left behind the violent chaos of the 1990s. Many theories centered on the end of Putin's second term as president, which was, by law, already on the horizon. Some saw the murders as a provocation to ignite a popular uprising before the election in 2008, the way Georgi Gungadze's murder in Ukraine hastened the end of Leonid Kuchma's rule. Others saw the dark hand of those inside Russia who wanted Putin to remain in power. By this logic, the opprobrium that would fall on Putin for orchestrating the murder of a critic in London would force him to remain in office to assure his immunity from criminal prosecution. Putin had been asked about his intention to revise the Constitution and seek a third term as president even before he had romped to re-election for a second term. Over and over, he insisted that he had no intention to change the Constitution to erase the term limits on the powerful presidency, and over, appeals were drafted to do exactly that. Regional parliaments proposed holding referendums on the issue from Primorye in the Far East to Chechnya. The speaker of Chechnya's parliament, Dugavaha Abdurakhmanov, echoed Ramzan Kadyrov in his fealty by declaring that Putin should have three or four more terms as president, that he should rule for life, if possible. The number of terms should not decide the end of his presidency, but rather his age and health, he said. With a simple signal from the Kremlin, any of the initiatives to extend Putin's rule would have passed easily. But Putin demurred, rebuffing the appeals, though he did not actively discourage them either. For the first time ever, the country had a legal, democratic mechanism for the peaceful transfer of power, but by Putin's own design, it had become impossible to imagine anyone else in charge. Putin once said he had been thinking about his potential replacement from the moment he took office, but by his second term, the question of succession had begun to concern Putin and his court the way it had the ailing Yeltsin, or the discredited Kuchma in Ukraine. He disclosed as much in December 2004 when he was asked at a press conference about his plans after leaving office and whether he would consider returning to politics in the following election in 2012. He joked, "Why not in 2016? His coy deflections never put the question fully to rest, but he acknowledged that, like Yeltsin before him, he had begun to think about the coming milestone of the 2008 election, which he cryptically called a critical line for the country. The search for Putin's heir, Operation Successor, it was called, began in earnest in November 2005 when the Kremlin announced that Putin had promoted two of his closest aides, Dmitry Medvedev, then his chief of staff, and Sergei Ivanov, the Minister of Defense. Putin elevated Medvedev to the newly created position of first deputy prime minister, while Ivanov became a deputy prime minister, in addition to Minister of Defense. Like Putin before his appointment by Yeltsin, neither man had run for elected office, but of the two, Ivanov seemed the more likely heir. He was 13 years older than Medvedev, and had risen to the rank of general in the KGB. Medvedev, by contrast, was a boyish, bookish lawyer who had co-authored a legal textbook and lectured at St. Petersburg State University's law school before following Putin to Moscow as his trusted protege. Putin told neither man whom he would choose, and in the following months it seemed that both were being groomed for the role, slipped into the public spotlight to burnish their images, though they were campaigning for the only vote that mattered, Putin's. They both now took prominent roles in policy initiatives. Medvedev oversaw $5 billion in spending on national projects in agriculture, housing, education, and healthcare. Ivanov, the restructuring of the military, and by 2006, a new commission to oversee military procurement. Both began appearing more often in nightly news reports, certainly more than their nominal boss, the colorless prime minister who ran the government, Mikhail Fradkov, who in his first year in office had become notable for his lack of political significance. As the speculation mounted, both Medvedev and Ivanov faced repeated questions about their political aspirations, and they became artful in deflecting the issue. In Putin's court, no one dared to campaign openly, even if they harbored political ambitions of their own. They conspired instead. The seeming solidity of Putin's political control belied a subterranean struggle to influence his ultimate choice. It was an extension of the struggle for control over the redistribution of assets that the Kremlin had orchestrated in earnest throughout Putin's second term. As in any court, rivalries emerged. Igor Sechin, whose power had increased with the acquisition of Rosneft, disliked the prospect of either of Putin's aides becoming president. He favored the prosecutor general, Vladimir Ustinov, who had played an important role in the Yukos affairs and whose son had married Sechin's daughter. Unfortunately for both men, a transcript of one of their conversations was said to have landed on Putin's desk in the spring of 2006. It had been taped surreptitiously by a deputy in Russia's Drug Enforcement Agency, which was then headed by Viktor Cherkasov, Putin's KGB colleague from Petersburg. In the wiretapped conversation, Sechin was said to have suggested, improbably, that Putin was weak, and Ustinov would make a suitable replacement. Whether it was true was not the point. Ustinov was nakedly ambitious, chairing meetings of prosecutors with a presidential air, which was a dangerous presumption. Emboldened by the takedown of Khodorkovsky, and with Sechin's blessing, he vowed publicly in May 2006 to prosecute high-profile criminal cases involving government officials, including, some argued, against Dmitry Medvedev. Putin dismissed Ustinov on June 2nd. The decision surprised the Federation Council, which still had the final authority to install or remove a prosecutor general, though no longer the independence it had under Yeltsin to debate doing so. In an indication of how much the balance of power had shifted in the 7 years since the scandal over Yeltsin's removal of Yuri Skuratov, the council voted the same day to affirm Putin's decision. There was no debate, and the vote was virtually unanimous, with only two abstentions. Sergei Ivanov hinted that there were good reasons for Ustinov's departure, but Putin offered no public explanation. No one understood then that the dismissal was the first ripple from the political turmoil beneath the surface. The murders of Politkovskaya and Litvinenko soon followed. The hidden battle over Putin's heir would not explode into public, however, until the following year, over an investigation into the furniture store Tri Kita, or Three Whales. It was the case Yuri Shekochekin had been circling around in his reporting when he died mysteriously. At the height of the furor over the Litvinenko investigation, Putin dispatched Medvedev to the annual meeting of the world's business and political elite at Davos, Switzerland, in January 2007. A little awkward, with a thick mat of brown hair and a musical taste for early American and British heavy metal, Medvedev projected a gentler image of a Russian politician than Putin had of late. Then only 41, he was a child of the intelligentsia, with no known background in the security services. He came of age as perestroika took root, representing a new generation less hardened by communism and the Cold War. He even spoke a smattering of English, picked up from his abiding passion for the music of Deep Purple. In his keynote speech, he reassured the audience that Gazprom was no bully, only weeks after it had suspended supplies to Belarus. He claimed that Russia had every intention of being a reliable partner in trade and investment, despite the Kremlin's role in squeezing investors like Royal Dutch Shell. He even took issue with the slogan Putin's political strategist, Vladislav Surkov, had popularized, sovereign democracy. Democracy, Medvedev said, needed no adjectives, and he was confident that Russia's version was genuine enough. We are not trying to push anyone to love Russia, but we won't allow anyone to hurt Russia, he said. We will strive to win respect both for the citizens of Russia and for the country as a whole. Moreover, this shall be achieved not by using force, but rather by our behavior and by our achievements. Medvedev's prominence at an international forum, Davos being a rite of passage for aspiring political leaders everywhere, was by and large well received, and it seemed to confirm his emergence as Putin's heir apparent. Medvedev's defense of Russia did not diverge substantively from Putin's, but the tone lulled the Davos attendees into believing him to be a different kind of leader. Less than 2 weeks later, however, Putin made it clear at another international forum that he was taking a much harder line against his detractors in the West, and above all, in the United States. The furor over the Politkovskaya and Litvinenko murders stoked Putin's anger, but the precipitating impulse for the speech he was about to deliver was President Bush's decision to negotiate the establishment of bases for the American missile defense system in Poland and the Czech Republic. In his mind, they were all of a piece. Putin had fiercely opposed Bush's decision to abandon the Cold War treaty prohibiting the deployment of national missile defenses, but he had acquiesced somewhat, reassured by the pledges to forge a new, more constructive friendship between the two countries. Instead, they had drifted further apart. Now, the United States wanted to put radar stations and interceptor missiles on Russia's flank. In the view of Putin and his military commanders, the deployment challenged the core of the country's nuclear deterrent, the one thing that had survived the collapse of the Soviet Union and preserved Russia's great power status. "I've had enough," he snapped at his aides. To express his vexation, Putin chose a forum often called the Davos of the National Security World, the annual Munich Security Conference. At the February 2007 gathering, following an opening address by German Chancellor Angela Merkel, Putin strode to the podium and began with a warning of what was to come. "This conference's structure allows me to avoid excessive politeness and the need to speak in roundabout, pleasant, but empty diplomatic terms. This conference's format will allow me to say what I really think about international security problems. And if my comments seem unduly polemical, pointed, or inexact to our colleagues, then I would ask you not to get angry with me. After all, this is only a conference." He jokingly hoped the conference's moderator would not turn on the red light, warning him his time was up. A smattering of uncomfortable laughs followed. Merkel, sitting in the front row, forced a smile. "The end of the Cold War," Putin went on, "left the world with live ammunition, figuratively speaking." He meant ideological stereotypes, double standards, and other typical aspects of Cold War bloc thinking. The collapse of the Soviet Union ended the geopolitical division of the world, but the resulting unipolar power was creating new divisions, new threats, and sowing chaos around the world. "It is a world in which there is one master, one sovereign," he went on. Instead of easing the world's tensions, unilateral and frequently illegitimate actions have resulted in more war and more deaths than in the divided world. "Significantly more," he repeated. "Significantly more. Today, We are witnessing an almost uncontained hyper-use of force, military force, in international relations, force that is plunging the world into an abyss of permanent conflicts. As a result, we do not have sufficient strength to find a comprehensive solution to any one of these conflicts. Finding a political settlement also becomes impossible. We are seeing a greater and greater disdain for the basic principles of international law, and independent legal norms are, as a matter of fact, coming increasingly close to one state's legal system. If anyone missed the point, he then singled out the United States, which had overstepped its national borders in every way. This is visible in the economic, political, cultural, and educational policies it imposes on other nations. Well, who likes this? Merkel watched with a stony face, as did the American delegation sitting in the front to her left, including President Bush's new Secretary of Defense, Robert Gates, and two senators who were regular fixtures at the gathering, John McCain and Joe Lieberman. Viktor Yushchenko of Ukraine, whose election he so vigorously fought, was to Merkel's right. Putin's speech went on for 32 minutes, a public dressing down of the West over a catalogue of grievances, from arms control treaties to the expansion of NATO, the development of missile defenses to that of weapons in space, all in his mind caused by the unchecked hubris of a superpower bent on dominating the world on its own terms. Other international organizations had to bend to its demands. Negotiations to admit Russia to the World Trade Organization became entangled with unrelated demands for greater freedom of speech. The Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, which had criticized elections under Putin, had become a vulgar instrument to interfere in the internal affairs of others. The reaction in the hotel ranged from stunned to furious. The American response came the next day. Gates defended American actions and, as a former intelligence officer himself and director of the CIA, who said he had evolved in the decades since 1989, offered a gentle rebuke to the man who seemingly had not. One Cold War was enough, he said. Putin's speech became a landmark in Russia's relations with the West, interpreted by many as a defining moment as significant as Winston Churchill's speech in 1946 that gave the world the phrase the Iron Curtain. Putin, as he had certainly intended to do, tapped into the global anger and anxiety about the United States under George Bush. The prison on Guantanamo, the rendition of prisoners in secret detention centers, the torture of terrorist suspects, the war in Iraq. Putin might be criticized for his tightening grip at home, for Russia's own atrocities in Chechnya and elsewhere, and even for the poisoning of Litvinenko, but many around the world, including some even in Europe and the United States, agreed with his assessment and openly cheered a country and a leader willing and able to provide a counter to unbridled American power. Russia was no Venezuela or Iran or some other enemy whose anti-Americanism could be easily brushed aside as the ravings of the weak and irrelevant. The German newspaper, Süddeutsche Zeitung, wrote after the speech that Putin's was a warning worth minding. The mother of all failures has been the paternalistic way in which the winner of the Cold War has treated the loser. Putin had not closed the door on working with the Americans entirely. He would make one last bold gambit to co-opt Bush's missile defenses. But in the seventh and last year of his presidency, Russia had regained its international swagger, emboldened by surging revenues from oil and gas. Medvedev had said as much in Davos, but in a soothing reassurance that now, only 2 weeks later, seemed weak. Putin was charting a new foreign policy that would be far more defiant, even hostile, toward the United States in particular, but also, in the wake of the Litvinenko murder, to Britain, too. He went from Munich to Saudi Arabia, once a vehement enemy of the Soviet Union, and then to Qatar, seeking to expand Russia's energy power with an OPEC for natural gas. Joining him on the trip was Sergei Ivanov, whose hawkish views hewed far more closely to Putin's rhetoric than Medvedev's. Medvedev's debut in Davos had been warmly received by the same international elite Putin had just dressed down. He had been seen as the front-runner in the unofficial primary race for the coming presidential election. But when Putin returned to Moscow a week later, it was Ivanov whom he promoted. There were now two first deputy prime ministers, and Ivanov was the one who seemed much more in tune with Putin's mood. Putin's Jeremiad in Munich also reverberated through the Russian military and security establishment, leading to an upsurge of threats and hostile acts not only against the United States, but also against the Europeans. The commander of Russia's strategic missile forces warned that he would retarget the country's nuclear weapons at Poland and the Czech Republic if they went ahead with the deployment of American military hardware. In April, Putin announced that Russia would suspend compliance with the Treaty on Conventional Armed Forces in Europe, a pact negotiated at the end of the Cold War to limit the number of armored vehicles, artillery batteries, and attack aircraft deployed across the continent. Putin's deliberate turn in Munich was like a whistle to a nation that shared his feelings of betrayal and besiegement. It unleashed a suppressed fury toward foreigners, even diplomats. When Estonia relocated a Soviet war memorial from a park in its capital, Tallinn, in April 2007, the country's computer network faced a crippling wave of cyber attacks that Estonian officials traced to computers in Russia, including one with an internet protocol address inside Putin's presidential administration. It was described as a cyber war, launched furtively by an increasingly bellicose Russia that no longer respected the sovereignty of its neighbors, exactly what Putin accused the United States of doing. In Russia, Nashi, the militant youth group created and nurtured by the Kremlin, laid siege to Estonia's embassy. Bodyguards for Estonia's ambassador, Marina Kalyurand, had to use pepper spray to escape Nashists who rushed her as she departed a press conference trying to calm tensions over the monument. Her car was attacked as it left, as was the Swedish ambassador's when he tried to visit the Estonian embassy. These breaches of diplomatic protocol were tolerated by the usually zealous Russian police. Nor did Putin let up on his public criticism of the American hegemon. At the annual Victory Day commemoration in Red Square on May 9th, he compared the United States to the Third Reich with its same contempt for human life and its same desire to rule the world by diktat. The stability of international relations and the security architecture constructed after the Cold War, an era that augured a new peace for the continent, was unraveling in a convulsion of mutual reproach. It was at this point that Britain's Crown Prosecution Service brought to a head its investigation of the poisoning of Alexander Litvinenko. In May 2007, it announced that there were sufficient grounds to accuse Andrei Lugovoy of the murder. The prosecutors did not make their evidence public then, but the British had concluded that only the Kremlin could have authorized such a brazen and risky operation. Russia defiantly refused to consider Britain's appeal for Lugovoy's extradition. Russia cited its own constitutional prohibition on extraditing its citizens, and the hypocrisy of Britain's repeated rebuffs of its own numerous appeals to bring Boris Berezovsky to justice in Russia. In April, Berezovsky had told The Guardian that he was actively financing an effort to foment a new revolution in Russia among the political and business elite, who he believed were the only hope of change, not the coming election for Putin's successor. "It isn't possible to change this regime through democratic means," he told the newspaper. "There can be no change without force, pressure." The Kremlin declared Berezovsky's threat a violation of the new law on extremism and renewed its demand for his extradition. Lugovoy held his own carnivalesque appearance before the press, mocking the indictment and accusing instead MI6, the British Foreign Intelligence Service, which had tried to recruit him, the Spanish branch of the Russian Mafia, presumably in retaliation for Litvinenko's meeting with the authorities there, and Berezovsky himself of the murder of the man he had once supported financially. He had himself been tainted with polonium-210, he said, for the future use in a political scandal. The spectacle heightened suspicion in Russia that Litvinenko's murder, like Politkovskaya's and the others, was part of an elaborate conspiracy to dictate the outcome of Russia's political transition. The only questions that remained were whether the conspirators were inside Russia or outside, and whether they were conspiring to keep Putin in power or to force him from it. In June, 2 days after Britain expelled 4 Russian diplomats in retaliation for Russia's refusal to extradite Lugovoy, the British police detained a mysterious Russian who had arrived in London on false papers. Suspecting him of intending to kill Berezovsky, they expelled him from the country. In July, the Royal Air Force fighter jets had to scramble to intercept Russian Tu-95 strategic bombers, testing British air defenses as the Soviet Union had done in the Cold War. It was as if the bear that was the Soviet Union had woken from 2 decades of hibernation.